Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 31st, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, this is what I call rush week. In other words, the end of the month when everything kind of falls in on me. Now, I've got a Radio Free Northwest I have to do, and a Northwest Observer to get written and printed and stuffed and into the mail. And in this case, it's also a Memorial Day weekend, so I had to press the flesh a bit, so to speak. This weekend, I went to not one but two NF get-togethers here in Washington State. One on Saturday and one on Monday. And it was, of course, great seeing everyone again and meeting some new comrades there as well. Anyway, because of all the things I need to do, I need to go ahead and put a rush on this week's show. So if it sounds a little basic and off the cuff, that's why. We've started the last couple of shows with some narcissistic naval contemplating discussion on the direction of the show itself after 2 years. And so this week I wanted to read you an email, which is pretty typical of the kind of response I've been getting. Dear HAC, I wanted to say that the panel discussion on last week's RFN was the best I've heard. I'm reluctant to criticize. You're an exceptional man to put this together, to reinvigorate the Northwest Imperative, to bring a level of sophistication to this idea. But I have to admit I was getting irritated by the lightheartedness of the panel discussions. What can I say? I was brought up on Dr. Pierce's broadcasts, and when I would finish listening to them, I was put into some kind of spiritual state, a hardened state, that motivated me enough to organize a cell, distribute literature, become active, so forth and so on. I've listened to this discussion 3 times now, parsing it for spiritual food. This is why Horace the Avenger strikes a chord. His broadcasts, as disjointed and rambling as they might be, strike a spiritual chord. You are the Hitler to his Himmler, the practical versus the spiritual side of the struggle. HTA is strengthening white souls. We whites are most effective when we've incorporated and assimilated our spiritual lives with our practical lives. We need to fervently believe in something. And there is a hunger amongst whites right now to believe in something higher than what has been proffered to them by the engineers of our destruction. The Northwest Imperative is the other side of the coin. It represents the practical expression of a people convinced of their planned genocide. Somehow, these two principles have to be brought together. Now, maybe the listeners should be given a spirit-hardening challenge to fast from, say, television watching for a week, or alcohol, something that will strengthen their will and give them the inner fortitude to take the ultimate step of packing up their things and joining their brethren in the Northwest. Everything we are surrounded by in today's America saps our strength to act. Our resistance has to start with the physical exercise of our inner selves. Signed, Mark in Illinois. Well, Mark, my first obvious response is that my listeners have been given a spirit-hardening challenge. That challenge is to get up out of their seats in whatever crummy furnished apartment or their mother's basement or whatever McMansion they're in, turn off the computer, pack a U-Haul trailer, and get out on the interstate heading northwest. That's their spirit-hardening challenge. A perfectly legal act, and one which is to your own personal advantage in the long run. But to be sure, it does involve a little bit of risk and inconvenience and a lot more physical activity than sitting there clicking the mouse and chomping on salty snacks that will eventually kill you. To be sure, some of you have passed this spirit hardening test. I know because I met some of you this weekend. For the rest, my constant ranting and raving on the subject is simply something you put up with while waiting to be entertained. But I get what you're saying, Mark, and it kind of dovetails with what most other people have been saying, that they want more focus on the show. I suppose it's a step in the right direction when people tell me that they want to be inspired and not entertained. Again, the fault is mine. Sally and I, and some of the others, have basically just had such fun doing the show that we forgot we're not here to have fun. Our bad. Tell you what, I've got about 2 more shows worth of this one big bull session we had last month with about 4 of us in here, and I might as well broadcast those rather than just let them sit around on my hard drive gathering dust. But after that, I'll try to get all grim and serious on you again, as indeed I probably should, considering what's coming down the pike. Now, this does not mean that I will no longer have guests on the program. I will. It doesn't mean that I don't want you guys to send in any more of your audio files. I do. It is still important to break up the sound of my droning and rambling voice with music and other stuff. And it's still important to remind you folks that there are other people involved in all this, and it's not just Harold sitting in some bedroom Berchtesgaden ranting away into cyberspace. But I will try to keep it more focused and serious and not wander off into topics like nigger butt cheeks or police officers who were assaulted with Justin Bieber dolls. You guys want grim and serious and focused. You want me to be more of a Piercean guru or maximal leader type, than maximal leader you shall have.
What do you mean you don't agree with me? Do you know who you're dealing with?
Sorry, I'm doing it again. I suppose I really should be taking all this seriously because it's becoming increasingly evident that no one really gets what's going to happen if Israel ignites another endless war in the Middle East and the Western world loses 1/3 of its imported oil. I think most people figure the price of gas will go up another dollar or two at the pumps. And like always, Americans will grumble and moan, but they'll pay. And our all-volunteer, no-draft army will once more be deployed and deployed and deployed until the end of time, keeping the Straits of Hormuz open, and a few hundred or more of them will commit suicide, and we'll get the usual horror stories about female soldiers getting raped and vets home from Iran going berserk and wiping out their families, so forth and so on. But hey, it will basically just be a rerun of Iraq and Afghanistan, and we've seen that show, right? No. I know this is getting into Prophet of Doom territory, but let's see if I can give you a little prediction, a blow-by-blow description of what will happen when Israel attacks Iran and the effect of that event on the world. Now, first off, to be absolutely accurate, I should begin by stating that there is still a possibility that this might not happen, that Benjamin Netanyahu is bluffing to try and get the rest of the world to gang up on Iran like the whole world did on Germany back in 1939. Now, this is, in essence, what Netanyahu is trying to pull off. He wants to get the Goyim to do all the fighting and dying for the Jews just like happened 80 years ago. Now, he may well pull it off, but there is also a possibility that the rest of the world may just tell Israel to go fuck itself, finally. Now, I know that's considered to be movement blasphemy, since we have this idea that the Jews control the whole world and pull all the strings and the Jews are all-powerful, blah, 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 which, by the way, is one attitude we really, really need to rethink, because it's not as true as it once was, and it has always been a lot more nuanced and complicated than that. But that's a rave for another time. Now, suffice it to say that it's possible that Netanyahu might yet be talked down from the ledge, or he might be bribed with billions more American tax dollars and all kinds of fancy new weapon systems, so forth and so on. Maybe we'll follow that line of possibility as it develops. But let's assume that Netanyahu can't get the other countries of the world to go along with him, or else he just plain freaks. I'm assuming that he will wait until after both nominating conventions here in the summer, and then into late September or early October. But then again, Yom Kippur is in October, and the Jews didn't have such good luck with the last war they started at that time of year. So he might strike as early as Rosh Hashanah, which is usually in early September, I believe. In any case, Obama will be right in the middle of an election campaign, and he couldn't possibly dump Israel then and lose all that lovely Jewish money and political support. A striking then is Netanyahu's way of making sure that he still has that complete, limitless blank check from the United States that Israel has had for the past 64 years. Now, first thing you have to understand about an airstrike against Iran's nuclear program is that the general consensus of military opinion, both in the United States and in Israel itself, is that it wouldn't work. The Persian nuclear labs and facilities are scattered all across a huge country the size of the state of California, and they are buried deep underground with state-of-the-art protection and fortification courtesy of Russia and China. Any air attack, including an attack by the United States, would at best delay the Iranian uranium enrichment program by maybe 6 months. Now, everybody concerned knows this, and so we have to assume that the purpose of the attack is not to stop the Iranian nuclear program, which can't be done, but deliberately to precipitate the very cataclysmic events that might send the balloon up if they're not careful and it gets away from them. Now, it could well be that Obama, or should I say Obama's handlers, bear in mind we're talking here about a nigger who's too stupid to address a class full of third graders without a teleprompter. Anyway, it could be that the people ruling us from behind the scenes, the little man behind the curtain, wants this coming catastrophe to essentially finish what 9/11 started and strip away the last of our constitutional freedoms in combination with Obama's coming push to legalize all the illegal aliens, get them registered to vote Democrat, and thus ensure perpetual power for the Democratic Party in what will essentially be a one-party state. The Republicans will still be around for a while, yelling and screaming and trying to represent the white minority in this country. And we will still technically be living in a democracy, but there's no point in living in a democracy when we are outnumbered and we will always be outvoted. You know what? I'm going to be talking a lot about this Jew attack on Iran thing in the coming months. And so rather than really let myself go here and just go on and on and on until I have a 45-minute tirade to edit that's going to take up the whole show, let's just move on for now. We will be returning to this topic, trust me.
Tonight, I would like to talk about a wonderful book called Family, Kin, and the City-State, The Racial Underpinnings of Ancient Greece and Rome. The book deals with religion in the Mediterranean, and it really explains the early culture of classical Greece and Rome in a way that nothing else I've ever come across does, because it makes the reader understand that religion in those days was very much passed down through a family lineage. And in the case of Greece and Rome, as in the case with most Indo-European religions, so through a patriarchal lineage, although it does note that the Germanic peoples actually reckoned lineage through both sides. So they were rather unique in that, and I think deserve a lot of credit for that. At any rate, this book deals with the Mediterranean, and what would happen is that because these religions were passed down in such a strictly lineal fashion, it was very important for a son to be legitimate. When a woman married, she would start serving at the heath and the altar of the husband. And in order to have a place in this society, early on at least, you had to be personally inducted by your father into this priesthood of the hearth. And then when you had an ancestor who died, then that ancestor would be buried in the family crypt. And so the family property was literally hallowed with the bones of ancestors who would then become revered and would have a rather godlike status. On this religion, social and political life was based. So if you were somehow outside of this system, then you really had no official place in the society. It said that the type of worship, very much like in Dharmic religions today, that the family would follow would again be passed down. A particular patron deity would generally be passed down. It said as time went on, there were also some nature deities that anyone could worship to a certain degree, but really, I've never seen anything that brings up the Dharmic underpinnings and the issue of the sacred fire and the communal meal in a way that this book does. It really dovetails very well with things like Vedic commentary, which I'm reading this really interesting Vedic commentary. It's a really long name, but it's called The Vedas by Sri Chandra Ras Kirdra Sirivedi that you can get on Amazon. And what a wonderful compliment that is to this book on ancient Rome. You know, you're really not going to understand ancient mythology or the early Greeks and Romans without reading this book. You can really understand the origin of the patrician-plebeian conflicts also because, of course, the patricians were the original founders, for example, of Rome, and the plebeians were people that were, for whatever reason, on the outside. And it really explains the patriotism of the ancients because it was so linked to the soil. Literally, they had to have soil ceremonies and sacred fire ceremonies when they wanted to found a new city. It was literally a religious act because they had to bring a sample of the soil from the old city and they had to bury it and they had to make a new fire. And if there was a foreigner in the site of the sacred fire, the fire would become unclean and it had to be extinguished and it had to be reignited. And honestly, this is a wonderful insight into how people thought in ancient times, and really, I think the title is a little bit deceiving. I think it was more of a lineage issue than strictly a racial issue. However, willy-nilly, there were certain families that were allowed to marry each other and other families that were not, so it was much more strict in terms of marriage. Much more an act for the continuance of the family line. It wasn't really so much for personal pleasure or personal whim. I'd really have to recommend this book. It's a fairly quick read, but I really find it very helpful in understanding ancient attitudes. So I thank you for listening, and I'm thinking next time I may be talking about Suicide of a Superpower by Buchanan. So I hope you tune in for that also.
Some of you may have seen a request I put on my blog for certain Rhodesian songs that I'm looking for in order to do a special Rhodey Mellows showcase for Radio Free Northwest. Now, thanks to your responses, I was able to get a few of them downloaded on MP3, but I would like to see if I can get hold of more, so we will hold that off until next week. Now, last week, through sheer coincidence, I played a selection of songs by the North Carolina folk and ballad singer Doc Watson. Now, to be honest, I thought he was already dead, but I was wrong. And this week, I was sorry to hear that Doc died, in fact, several days ago, in the hospital of pneumonia at the age of 89. Now, I know that sometimes some of the music I play on here seems a little obscure and esoteric to most of you who were probably raised on Pearl Jam and Talking Heads, but Doc was an important figure in white history in this country. He was the last of the old guys who learned traditional Appalachian ballads and songs and clawhammer banjo picking and whatnot, quite literally, at his mother's knee up in Deep Gap, North Carolina, in the ancient oral tradition that goes back to Homer. And no, I don't mean Homer Simpson. These were the old guys that you used to see wandering out of the mountains to places like the Galax and Union Grove Fiddlers Conventions, and they'd sit on a stump by a fire swinging on a bottle of something and pick or fiddle away at tunes that went back to 16th century Scotland. Now, that's another thing I got to see in my youth before the old white world vanished, and which I'll always be grateful for. You know, when I was 17, I once played on the same stage as Bill Monroe. Me and about 75 other miscellaneous pickers and would-be country singers and whatnot. That was at Union Grove, 1971, I think. 70 or 71, can't remember now. Anyway, last week we had Doc Watson featured on this program, and this week we're going to have another one of the last of such old Appalachian mountain men, Ralph Stanley, who's from up around Dickinson County, Virginia, and if you don't know where that is, join the club. It's up past Lynchburg somewhere. Ralph is 85 years old, and he's still going strong, although unlike Doc, he actually became a professional musician. This is a song he did in concert with Patti Loveless.
You're ready for Pretty Polly.
I'm ready.
Okay. Oh, Polly, Pretty Polly, would you take me in kind? Polly, Pretty Polly, would you take me in kind? You just sit beside me and tell me you're mine. Polly, come and go along with me. Polly, Pretty Polly, come and go along with me. Before we get married, some pleasure we'll see.
Where he led her over mountains and valleys so deep. He led her over mountains and valleys so deep. Polly mistrusted and them began to
is about right. Polly, Pretty Polly, your guess is about right. I dug on your grave the biggest part of last night.
Then he led her a little farther, and what did she spy? He led her a little farther, and what did she spy? New dug grave with spit lying by. She knelt down before him and pleading for her life. She knelt down before him pleading for her life. Let me be a single girl if I can't be your wife.
Well, Polly, Pretty Polly, that never can be. Polly, Pretty Polly, that never can be. Your past reputation's been trouble to me.
Then he opened up her bosom. Snow. Open up her bosom as white as any snow and stabbed through the heart and blood it overflowed.
And he went down to the jailhouse and what did he say? He went to the jailhouse and what did he say? Kill Pretty Polly and trying to get away.
guys, this is Axis Sally. It's not generally known that before and during World War II, many prominent Americans agreed with National Socialism and Fascism, such as Charles Lindbergh, Henry Ford, H.P. Lovecraft, and Ambassador Joseph Kennedy, the father of JFK and Senator Robert Kennedy. Some Americans even aided Germany and Italy during the war, such as my namesake, the original Axis Sally, in Germany, and Ezra Pound in Fascist Italy. Ezra Pound was a brilliant American poet. His genius led him to quickly discover the real origin and agenda of the Jews who had flooded into the U.S. Just as did Henry Ford, Pound set about to inform the general public. That was his mistake. Such a penetrating intellect as Pound's would naturally not be oblivious to the external world. As did Henry Ford, Lindbergh, and others, Ezra Pound was able to discern that the Jews were fomenting war and revolutions wherever they went. Pound understood much about economics and the structuring of legal and financial vehicles which were put in place by the Jews. Pound could see that the so-called Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and the death of the Tsar, as well as the slaughter of millions of Russian and Ukrainian peasants, was in fact almost entirely yet another Jewish adventure. He understood well the true reasons for World War II and desperately sought to avoid America's entry, as did Henry Ford. Living as he did outside the U.S. and away from the Jewish media control, Pound was able to see that once again the Jews were fomenting genocide in 1930s Germany. Though it still is not taught in American history books, in 1933 there was a formal declaration of war made against Germany by the Jews. The Jews sought to do the same thing in Germany as they had done to Russia. Though never reported in the U.S. press, the communists actually took over parts of Germany and even briefly established a Soviet Republic of Bavaria before they were defeated by the returning German soldiers of the Freikorps, or Free Corps. All this Ezra Pound acutely understood. He could see either another series of mass murders in Germany, as had taken place in Russia, or that Germany must otherwise repulse the world onslaught of the Jews. During World War II, Pound was living in Italy. He broadcast several lectures via Italian radio and was rightfully critical of Franklin Roosevelt and his Jewish minions. Like Ford, Lindbergh, and others opposing manipulated events and Jewish-controlled media, Ezra Pound paid the ultimate price. After the close of World War II, he was seized by U.S. authorities and subjected to months of physical and psychological torture. The 60-year-old Pound was kept outdoors in a specially constructed open cage for several months in the blazing Italian sun, with searchlights turned on him by night. He was kept starved and dehydrated in a clear attempt to induce death by so-called natural causes. He was told that he was going to be killed and subjected to several false executions by firing squad right up to the moment where the rifleman fired blanks. Eventually, he was taken to the U.S. where he was to be tried as a war criminal. Interestingly enough, the actual papers and indictment charging Pound with treason were drawn up by none other than Alger Hiss, who was later convicted himself of being a communist spy. Months of torture had rendered Ezra Pound mentally unfit for trial, or at least that was the official story. In actual fact, Pound had retained a clear mind in spite of his horrific mistreatment, and he would have defended himself by attacking Roosevelt, the war, and the Jews, which of course could never be allowed. Ezra Pound, the 20th century's greatest poet and historian of poetry, was then placed in an insane asylum. He was consigned to St. Elizabeth's Hospital for 12 years, while controversy still raged about him. On the one side were genuine patriots and literary giants seeking to have the outrageous charges dismissed. On the other side were the relentless Jews who sought to have Pound tried and executed as a war criminal. Finally, in 1958, the poet Robert Frost was instrumental in petitioning for Pound's release. While he was imprisoned at the asylum, Ezra Pound was able to dictate to the author Eustace Mullins much of his work in unraveling the self-serving economic constructs the Jew had installed both in the U.S. and worldwide. After release from St. Elizabeth's Hospital, Ezra Pound returned as a free man to Italy, where he lived another dozen years. The moral, if there is any here, is that a man so intelligent as Ezra Pound should have been able to anticipate the degree of influence that the Jews would be able to marshal against all adversaries. Historically, they have been able to either directly buy up sources of public information, newspapers, radio, TV, or bulk to that device, they are able to simply bribe or coerce the free press into absolute silence. Pound ought to have put more effort into studying the mechanisms the Jews might employ against an influential man of letters who was boldly speaking out the truth of world affairs.
Thank you. Let me clear out some of this tuberculosis from my lungs.
Yeah. Cough it in Sally's face.
I don't want your AIDS.
Oh.
It's just HIV right now, baby.
Okay. I'm good with that.
Yeah. My viral load's still down.
Slight touch of leprosy.
Now, see, the problem is here. You want to be a gift giver, but she does not want to be a bug chaser. So,
oh,
you guys
wow.
not familiar with those terms?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Elevate,
talk
assholes.
Talk about that on
Elevate.
Your own show. This is a respectable program.
Nigger butt cheeks.
Are we done cackling?
I am. I don't know about Sally.
Okay, so I think there's a lot of work that can be done with recruiting, working with non-racially aware whites. And perhaps we spend some of our energy in ways that aren't going to bear fruit. We're never going to get anything out of it. We shouldn't waste our time arguing with brown people. I mean, unless you have like a fetish with fighting the nigger at work. Sure. I mean, yeah, if you're stuck at work and you have a coworker that's black, yeah, go ahead, banter with them as long as you don't get fired. But let's not delude ourselves that you're going to like convince a black to kill black people. And then even if you did, he's still not getting into the NF. Sorry, pal. It's like if a white woman already has black kids, what good is it explaining to her that she's a race traitor? Just let it go. Don't even waste the energy on her. I'm going to steal a line from the Masons, and no, I'm not a Mason, but the Masonic Order has this thing that our goal is to make bad men good and good men better. And I think as NFers or any racially aware white person, we should always seek to wake up or to plant ideas about white genocide and about white separatism, white nationalism with them and showing them how whites should cohese together and choose their race over other races and seek a better life. And then for those that are already racially aware, after the seed is planted or somebody else has come along and introduced it to them, the person's already been in the movement, that's when you begin to work with them and nurture them and train them up, mentor them to the idea of actually a white homeland.
All right, what we're doing here, we're just going over some of the news items for today. DNC staffer's Facebook photo causes controversy. A DNC gets to be on Facebook. We don't. Jewbag staffer. Okay. Officials question hiring of Jewbag staffer. Okay.
I question hiring of Jewbag staffers.
Okay. Staffer for the Democratic National Committee chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is a Jew.
Sounds like a Jewbag.
She is.
She is a vile.
Yeah, right. Who posted the controversial Jewbag photo on her Facebook page in 2006 is no anonymous aide, but the daughter of Mark and Nancy Gilbert, two major Florida donors who have raised more than $500,000 for the Obama campaign. Well, it doesn't say, is she an actual Jew? Is she a Jewbag? Danielle Danny Gilbert, according to party sources, was tapped by Wasserman Schultz. She must be, if that Jew female would hire her, to serve as liaison to the Jewish community. Okay. Maybe she meant she was a Jewish bag woman, which is what her parents are, apparently, for Obama. Okay. Liaison to the Jewish community, even though party officials and people close to Obama told her that more senior Democrats were already handling. In other words, it was a patronage job. These two people raised $500,000 for Obama, and they wanted somebody to give their useless little Jap daughter a job where she didn't have to actually do any work. Okay, Wasserman Schultz has thus far refused to fire or discipline Gilbert, whose gallery of candid photos and personal commentary, wonder what kind of candid photos, has been removed from her public Facebook page, according to Democrats. I apologize for any harm, blah, 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 blah. Okay, anyway, apparently this Jewish woman put a photo of herself on Facebook calling herself a Jewbag, and everyone's all upset. Well, I guess...
Let's look at her. Is she a Jewbag?
I don't know. Okay, her name is Danielle Gilbert. I'll have to bring up another browser here and see if I can get onto Google. Let's see if we can find a picture of her. Okay.
Whatever you're doing, it's wrong.
Oh,
you didn't spell it right.
God damn it.
Damn it, Sally. Why'd you do that to him?
That's all these damn stupid pop-up things they have on the damn...
like that?
Like that.
Control F is what happened.
Okay, probably my fingers are just too fat to... I did it again. God damn it.
There's a reason I have a boom for my microphone.
It's not...
Because I can reach my computer then.
Okay.
The boom actually came free. The problem was I had to buy the $325 microphone to get it.
Oh. Okay, Danielle Gilbert, images. Let's see what we can find. Which one is the Jew bag?
There's a nigger bag.
Okay. Okay.
Fag bag.
Danielle Gilbert. See, large Danielle Gilbert.
How do we know?
She doesn't look large.
Stop the Facebook stalking by Danielle Gilbert, who's stalking her on...
Probably Jew bags.
That looks like a Jew bag.
Oh, Jesus. Look at that proboscis.
Proboscis, actually.
Okay, whatever, heck.
Just goes to show how sensitive these people are to any mention even of the word Jew. I wonder how sensitive they're going to be in a few months when Israel attacks Iran and closes the Strait of Hormuz and we got $17 a gallon gasoline. I wonder if it'll be acceptable to mention Jews then.
I guess it won't matter if you get fired from your job because you can't afford to drive there anyway, right?
Yeah.
This will do it, guys. This will bring the balloon up. We know. This is it now. Gas will do it, yeah.
No, there's always the ghetto limousine you can ride. Yeah. Take the bus.
Here in this county where I live, back when the budget crunch first hit about 2 years ago, they had to cut out about half of the bus lines, the bus routes, because people weren't paying property taxes anymore because they were all being foreclosed or they were out of work and they just couldn't pay their damn taxes.
Well, that and 3/4 of the people that have jobs for the bus make over $100,000 a year.
Well, there's that as well. But again,
a fat nigger bitch with freaking roly-poly rolls spilling into the aisle driving the bus and she's making $120,000.
Okay, 1/3 of the world's imported oil from the Middle East gets cut off, which is the estimate as to what will happen when they close the Straits of Hormuz. That's going to shoot gasoline up to an estimated $17 a gallon here until such time as they can get the shale oil fields in South Dakota and whatnot going, but that's going to be some years. And it's not just the cost of gasoline for our cars at the pump. It's the cost of fuel for electric generation plants, electric generators. The cost of the fuel for the trucks to bring our food and everything we need to the stores all around the country because, like idiots, we let our railways just deteriorate into nothing.
No. We didn't let them deteriorate. That's a whole conspiracy theory right there about car companies pulling up all the rail lines.
Car companies and the Teamsters Union. But that actually might cause the balloon genuinely to go up because the economic wreckage that it would make of this country would be such that we have, 50, 60 million white people who just no longer care anymore because they will have literally lost everything. A lot of white people have lost a lot right now. They've lost their house, their McMansion that they were paying the $500,000 mortgage on, and they've had to move into a rented apartment or a trailer or something like that, but that's still shelter of a kind. They've lost their job, but now they're flipping burgers at a McDonald's or pushing a broom or stacking pallets or something like that, but it's still a job. When the whole thing goes down...
And all that's true, but you're never going to convince them that it's because of niggers or Mexicans. That's the problem. You're not going to convince these white people, middle-class white people that have lost their jobs, that are paying more in taxes, that are working longer hours and getting paid less. Kids have to go to school with niggers and Mexicans and get taught that sucking cock is okay. They're just people too, and God created them. Okay. Yeah, right. And so to try and convince those people that it's because of the mass third world immigration, it's almost an impossibility. And I hate to sound like a defeatist, but the minute you try and raise any kind of racial awareness with people that you would think would be racially aware, well, you're a white supremacist. The minute you mention anything, and just intelligent conversation and not anything disparaging, just mentioning the fact of Jews and how bad they are, you're an anti-Semite, and that automatically closes down the argument.
I don't know. This is one thing I think that a lot of movement people sort of debate among ourselves and argue about among ourselves over. Really, just how stupid are the masses of white people? I myself believe that, they're dumb, but... One of the reasons they're dumb, and they have been dumb in the past, is because they've had too much to lose, and they kind of didn't want to know. Now, what we're talking about here is a situation where tens of millions of white people literally, like I said, don't have anything to lose anymore, not even their double-wide trailers and their 15-year-old pickup trucks, and they're literally on the edge of, they're living off the food bank, and they're about to go under the bridge at night. And the thing is that with these white people, when you take away what the system uses to retaliate, what the system uses to keep white people in line, which is their wealth, their material possessions, their standing in the community. If these people have already lost these things, they're not going to really care if they say Jew or nigger anymore because, I mean, what's society going to do to them that hasn't already been done to them? So it's possible. I think we're going to find out to what degree the white population of this country is really that effing stupid and to what degree they've just been keeping keeping quiet because it was in their interest to do so. Something else, I keep harping on this, we don't really need millions and millions of people. The type of situation that I envision in my novels and for the Northwest Front can be carried out and can be achieved with only a few people, relatively speaking, just a few thousand people. We don't need to have a Weimar-style movement with long brown columns marching down the street. And since we're not planning on getting voted into office, we don't need to convince these morons to vote for us. So, I don't know, maybe they really are that stupid, maybe it all really is hopeless, maybe our people have just been so deracinated and so brainwashed and so fucked over by the system that they're totally useless and, oh, it's all so hopeless. Maybe. I don't know. But I think we're going to find out, and I think we will find that when push comes to shove and white people really don't have anything to lose anymore, then they no longer have any incentive to keep quiet about what they've known for a long time. At least I hope that's the way it's going to turn out.
So I'm wondering if you think really the balloon could go up in just a few months. I mean, what would your response be if you found out or if somebody told you, hey, guess what, Harold? Last night I wrapped myself in a tricolor flag and I blew up this Jew place and then I killed this family of niggers and I spray painted NVA on the wall. And so what do you think?
Well, that is something we were talking about earlier. There's several ways that that could happen. I believe I was talking to Andy about this earlier when he came before you other guys showed up. I do not myself at present plan on forming the NVA and going out and starting shooting people, but that doesn't necessarily mean that others may not be. When I wrote the novels and I got into this whole Northwest Front thing, one of the things I had to accept was the possibility that at some point in time, some people just weren't going to be willing to wait anymore. Now, my attitude towards that, if it were to happen, if, say, some other group of people were to form the NVA and go out and start taking proactive action against the enemy and so forth and so on, I would try to function just in the same way that Sinn Féin does in Ireland with the Provisional IRA, but I doubt the federal government would allow that. Realistically speaking, if anybody starts doing that, the feds are just going to come and sweep me up and lock me under the jug for alleged conspiracy or incitement or for being me or whatever, for writing the books, whatever they can think of. And they can do that now. All these laws like the Patriot Act, Military Commissions Act of 2006, the National Defense Authorization Act. You know, Obama can legally arrest, detain, and execute anybody he wants. So if that were to happen, if, say, some other little group were to start up NVA-style action here in the Northwest, the feds would just simply pick me up and drag me away to some hole someplace or whatever. But that's okay. I'm okay with that as long as these people who are actually taking the action win and as long as they actually inflict some serious damage on the enemy. Now, what I would be leery of is the feds doing, in essence, what they did, I think, in Oklahoma City, what they did in 9/11. Now, I would not put it past our federal government at all to start up a whole little bogus guerrilla campaign up here in the Northwest using the name NVA just as a way of getting more budget for the Spokane FBI office or whatever. They're really starting to squabble in government circles over who gets what cut of the budget. The BATFE wants this much and the FBI wants this much and the Department of Homeland Security, nobody likes them because they're not really necessary. They're just a third leg that was invented by George W. Bush to give jobs to the boys and girls and the neocons that supported him. It's kind of like George W. Bush's version of Akron. But I would not put it at all past the federal government to run a whole bogus terrorist campaign in order to get people all terrified and scared and hand over what's left of their liberties to the government and so forth and so on. So it could be, that would be the case. By the way, if anybody ever does start doing this stuff, I can tell you how to discern whether or not it's really genuine nationalists or whether it's some kind of FBI false flag or COINTELPRO type operation. And that is if the targets are kindergartens and old folks' homes and hospitals and the NVA allegedly ends up, you know, shooting down cute little pickaninnies and pigtails and all that sort of stuff. That will be a government disinformation and black ops situation. You may remember that section in the brigade I had about target selection, and also I mentioned that the NVA kind of had an unspoken arrangement with the federal government that they would not engage in black ops of that kind. No bombs going off in kindergartens or old folks' homes, and no NVA allegedly claiming credit and that sort of stuff, because otherwise the real NVA would start bringing down airliners. This, of course, was fictional in the book. Fictional. Okay, this is Ralph Stanley from a movie made about 10 years ago called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Now, I know I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for saying this, but I actually liked it. Yes, it was viciously anti-Southern, but so much so that it was funny. Kind of like a cartoon. Kind of like the original Batman TV series. It was so bad it was camp. And it had a kicking soundtrack, which, among other things, featured Ralph Stanley playing the Grand Dragon in a Klan rally. And he gets up, and instead of making a racial speech to the cross-lighting ceremony, for some reason born in the bizarre brain of some Hollywood scriptwriter, he sings a very strange but authentic old mountain song a cappella called O Death.
O Death, O Death, won't you spare me over till another year? Well, what is this that I can't see with ice cold hands taking hold of me? Well, I am death, none can excel. I'll open the door to heaven or hell. Oh, death, someone would pray, could you wait to call me another day? The children prayed, the preacher preached, time and mercy is out of your reach. I'll fix your feet till you can't walk, I'll lock your jaw till you can't talk. I'll close your eyes so you can't see this very hour come and go with me. Death, I come to take the soul, leave the body and leave it cold. To drop the flesh off of the frame, the earth and worm both have a claim. Oh, death, oh, death, won't you spare me over till another year? My mother came to my bed, placed a cold towel upon my head. My head is warm, my feet are cold, death is a-moving upon my soul. Oh, death, how you treating me? You're closed my eyes so I can't see. Well, you're hurting my body, you make me cold, you run my life right out of my soul. Oh, death, please consider my age, please don't take me at this stage. My wealth is all at your command, if you will move your icy hands. Oh, the young, the rich or poor, all alike me, you know. No wealth, no land, no silver, no gold, nothing satisfies me but your soul. Oh, death, oh, death, won't you spare me over till another year? Won't you spare me over till another year? Won't you spare me over till another year?
I've often ranted and raved on this program about how it's necessary for us to break out of the bubble, to get away from this incestuous and dysfunctional little movement of ours and begin drawing our audience, our support, and our recruits from the white community at large here in the Northwest. It's true that the number of hits on the NorthwestFront.org websites is rising, and we're approaching 5,000 unique hits per week, but that's just plain not fast enough, especially since we now seem to be racing the clock with this Jew attack on Iran business. I've already pretty much beaten this topic to death, but I actually got a fairly intelligent question from a comrade the other day who pointed out that we're going to need more than a small handful of people posting the links northwestfront.org all over the internet. Somehow or other, we're going to have to catch fire to really go viral, as the saying goes, and he wonders how this might happen. Well, it could happen in a number of ways. I keep hoping I can maybe piss off Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck and get them to denounce us on their shows, because their audiences contain a large number of whites who are only there because they think it's the strongest stuff available, and they'd be really thrilled to get a listen to Radio Free Northwest where somebody actually has the guts to say nigger. But I think Limbaugh and Beck are too canny to fall for anything that we might do as a publicity stunt to draw their attention. However, if any of you have any ideas along that line, by all means, lay them on me. Now, the way in which I kind of hope it doesn't happen is that there's some kind of spectacular and bloody event that the media decides to link with the Northwest Front in an attempt to blame it on us, and that will get enough curiosity hits so that all of a sudden you got white people all over the country emailing their friends and contacts and their sewing circles and bowling clubs and whatnot saying, "Hey, wow, get a look at this, guys." Problem is, of course, whether or not we could survive as a movement and capitalize on that. Now, ideally, what we need is for somebody like Arianna Huffington or Jon Stewart of the Daily Beast to discover us and start ranting and raving and hollering about us wicked racists to the point where the mainstream media picks up on it and we start getting attention from somebody besides the Huffington Post readers and Daily Show watchers and so forth and so on. Now, that almost happened with the Bionic Backpack incident in Spokane last year, when Rachel Maddow, or Maddow, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, found us and freaked out and screamed at us on our stupid show. Now, she vowed and swore that we were somehow responsible for the backpack, and how the mainstream media weren't doing their moral duty to expose us and sick the FBI on us, blah, 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 blah. And how from now on, she was going to be all over us like white on rice. And she also denounced us on her show's blog and got hundreds of responses, both pro and con, some from our own people who got into the act, including myself. Now, that lasted exactly 2 days, and then all of a sudden, zoink, the blog thread was locked. All of the pro-NF posts, including my own, were yanked offline, and there hasn't been a whisper about us from Rachel Maddow since then. Now, obviously, what happened was somebody in authority in the media or the government gave her a call and said, "Hey, Rach, we need to clue you in on this. These Northwest Front people do not get publicity, period." Now, this may also be the reason that I haven't been so much as mentioned by Morris Dees and the Southern Poverty Law Center for almost 5 years, which is odd. Morris and Mark are always looking for some new wicked racist threat that they can use as a fundraising gimmick to frighten the little old colored mammies and the aging Jewish red diaper babies on their lists into running home and breaking open their cookie jars and sending all their money to that nice Mr. Dees so he can save them from the Klansmen and the Nazis under the bed. Another theory about that is that Morris understands enough to know that we happen to be a genuine threat, and that any publicity given to us would backfire on him in the form of enough exposure to make white people as a whole aware of our existence, especially the existence of the Northwest novels. Now, if Morris and his liberal buddies have any real biopolitical sense at all, which is a debatable proposition, they're probably scared shitless of my books, and they don't want to risk more white people reading them. So that's one way we might get this show on the road, some spectacular bit of propaganda of the deed or other event that the media establishment simply cannot ignore. Now, this, of course, presumes that the NF could survive as a movement, the resulting FBI crackdown, as they went bonkers trying to make whatever it was some kind of conspiracy that they can blame on us. Now, this has already happened once, I think. If I recall from references he made on Facebook, J.T. Reddy had read at least a few of the Northwest novels. Now, I don't recall sending him any copies myself, but he may have downloaded them from the internet or ordered them directly. Oh, they're not going to try and pursue that, though. Apparently, I called it correctly, and J.T. Reddy was an FBI informant. Like I said, he wasn't one of our kooks, he was one of theirs. And that incident already seems to be headed down the memory hole. So, how else could it happen? Well, don't laugh at this, but there is always the possibility that we may somehow become chic. No, really. Bear in mind that, like all decaying and degenerate societies, people in Obama's America are always looking for titillation to relieve their boring and pointless consumer-driven lives. Some new fad, some new spectacle, some new diversion to while away the endless days and months and years as they slouch towards death, especially the idle rich, of whom this country has a large supply. Idle rich people will do anything to prevent being bored, and maybe we can somehow latch on to that. Remember the radical chic in the 1960s with Leonard Bernstein and the whole New York socialite scene hosting fundraising events for the Black Panthers? Complete with a dozen or so real-life badass niggers from the ghetto wearing black berets and waving guns in the air to mow-mow the trembling and fascinated rich Jews and white folks? Plus, we do have another generation of white teenagers coming up, emos and brainless valley girl sluts though they may be, and teenage kids of every generation are always looking for something that they can get into in order to shock their parents. Now, the problem is that in a society where every taboo has already been smashed down and nothing is really forbidden anymore, and where most parents have this idea that they need to tolerate pretty much any damn thing from their children and allow them to express themselves and all that kind of crap, really, nothing shocks anymore. Well, there's drugs, of course, but that's not really shocking. That's just a mess, and everybody's doing it. There's buggery and perversion, and I suppose some kids get into that garbage in order to get back at their folks, but unless they themselves are really sick and twisted and damaged, they usually don't get too far into it. I mean, what young white boy today really wants to live out his whole life as a faggot? Only the ones who are messed up beyond the point of no return, and them we don't need. Now remember, young people of every generation have a tendency to revolt against authority and revolt against the establishment, whatever that establishment is. And in our day and time, the establishment is left-wing and liberal. The establishment is Barack Hussein Obama and Arianna Huffington and John Stewart and teachers in the schools who cram politically correct crap down white kids' throats that they know is crap. They're just looking for an outlet to express what they instinctively feel. Now, this is why I need your help. There are millions of white kids in high school and junior high and college out there. Somehow, they need to find their way to northwestfront.org. Okay, I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for this one, but here goes. Whether all you rabid, foaming-at-the-mouth anti-Christians out there like it or not, fundamentalist Christianity of the Holy Roller kind is an innate part of American history and culture, especially in the South, and most white Americans are part and parcel of that heritage of many centuries, a heritage that a couple of generations of political correctness can't wash away overnight. And that's why the NF must never be associated in the public mind with anti-Christianity of any kind, by which I mean violent attacks on Christianity, calling Jesus a dead Jew on a stick, and that kind of garbage. In the South, gospel music is part and parcel of the bluegrass and folk tradition. On a Grand Ole Opry, back in the day, you could always tell when Flatt and Scruggs were about to do a gospel number because they took their hats off. Yeah, I know all the problems that fundamentalism causes with Zionism and so on, but like it or not, it's there in all of us somewhere. And we need to accept that and learn how to take the good and leave the bad behind. This is Ralph Stanley.
All you washed in the blood, in the soul-cleansing blood of the Lamb. Are your garments spotless? Are they white as snow? Are you born in the blood of the Lamb? Have you been to Jesus for the cleansing power? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Are you fully trusting in His grace is there? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Are you washed in the blood, in the soul-cleansing blood of the Lamb? Are your garments spotless? Are they white as snow? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Are you walking daily by the Savior's side? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Do you rest each moment in the crucified? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Are you washed in the blood, in the soul-cleansing blood of the Lamb?
Are your garments spotless? Are they white as snow? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb? Lay aside the garments that are stained with sin and be washed in the blood of the Lamb. There's a fountain flowing for the soul unclean. Oh, be washed in the blood of the Lamb. Are you washed in the blood, in the soul-cleansing blood of the Lamb? Are your garments spotless? Are they white as snow? Are you washed in the blood of the Lamb?
In my novel, A Mighty Fortress, I deal with the peace conference in Longview, Washington, wherein the Northwest American Republic is brought into being after a 5-year guerrilla struggle. Prior to that conference, the NVA issues a 12-point manifesto that outlines their position. I'm going to read that aloud now, and you YouTubing types out there might want to snip this for some more of those fine videos I see that you're making for upload. This is from the novel A Mighty Fortress by H.A. Covington. It's a document issued by the Political Bureau of the Northwest Volunteer Army, and it is entitled The Moral and Political Basis for Northwest Independence. Point number one. The United States of America, in its original form, as envisioned by the Founding Fathers, was a political entity created by and for white people. The white race made America what it is today. American law and the United States Constitution are derived from Anglo-Saxon common law, going back to the Magna Carta. Such concepts as democracy itself and the rule of law are based upon European thought, not African or Asiatic. Point number two. The United States of America, as it exists today, has only the most remote and tenuous historical connection with the country and the system of government which was originally established and envisioned by the Founding Fathers. The United States was never intended by the Founding Fathers to be multiracial or multicultural or diverse. It was intended to be a national expression of what was viewed at the time as the manifest destiny of the white race. This is made abundantly clear by contemporary documents from the time of the Founding Fathers, in the writings of men such as Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and Benjamin Franklin. Indeed, the only references to non-whites in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were in passing, where Indians are referred to as enemies of the colonists, and where, for census and apportionment purposes, blacks were considered to be 3/5 of a man. Point number three. The present government of the United States of America has become irredeemably corrupt, and its continuation in power is antithetical to the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The United States has become tyrannical, poisonous, and deeply repulsive to every concept of human decency. America today is riddled with crime, corruption, poverty, sexual perversion, unemployment, ill health, mistreatment of the elderly, the destruction of the national infrastructure, a dysfunctional educational system, and national malaise and demoralization. America today has been bankrupted and morally poisoned by a series of foreign wars fought on behalf of the Jewish people, which are in fact counter to America's interests. Wars which have been as pointless as they were immoral. These problems simply did not exist to any significant degree in the past when the white man was in charge. Point number four. It is clear beyond any debate that modifying the racial composition of America away from the dominant white society that it was as it rose to power toward a mixed, racially diverse society has been catastrophic, an unmitigated disaster. Diversity does not impart strength. It creates weakness, division, chaos, corruption, and deep social sickness. Diversity has ruined America. Even if all races were exactly the same, if there were no differences whatsoever, the fact that whites created America as we now know it today means that we now have the right to demand that at least a portion of what we have created be set aside for our exclusive use. We did not create this great and wealthy country just to hand it over to an endless flow of mud-colored immigrants who have done nothing to earn what we have made and who do not belong here at all. Point number five. For the past century, all peaceful attempts to alter and reverse the racial and social policies of the United States have failed. Petitions have been ignored. The electoral and political process has been undermined and corrupted and turned into a weapon of genocide against America's white inhabitants. The judiciary has become an instrument of racial and social tyranny. The United States has persistently refused to respond to all peaceful and legal efforts at reform. All peaceful and legal avenues of redress having failed or been closed off, it is therefore not only the moral right but the profound duty of all Americans of European descent to take up arms against the United States and apply such force and coercion as may be necessary to compel the government of the United States to change its wicked and destructive behavior and to punish those who are responsible for such behavior. Point number 6. Based upon the extensive history of the black and mestizo races, it is clear that they are not capable of creating or maintaining an advanced society. It was not Africans who invented such things as the wheel and gunpowder, forged steel, domesticated the horse, sailed the world on voyages of exploration and conquest, invented aviation and charted the mysteries of the human body. It was Europeans. Third world immigration eventually means a third world country. Racial integration and diversity is like mixing horse manure and ice cream. It does wonders for the manure, but it doesn't do much at all for the ice cream. Point number 7. The loathsome perversion of homosexuality is absolutely unacceptable in any civilized society. It must be exterminated with fire and sword. This is not something that is subject to debate or argument. It is simply something that decent men do. Point number 8. The unspeakable practice of infanticide by abortion is absolutely unacceptable in any civilized society. It must be brought to a halt immediately, and those who are guilty of trafficking in or profiting by this horror must be tried and punished for premeditated murder. This is not something that is subject to debate or argument. It is something that decent men simply do. Point number 9. The moral perversion known as feminism is destructive of the family, which is the basic building block of society, because it teaches the false idea that men and women are somehow competitors and enemies, and that the bearing and rearing of white children is somehow shameful. No more pernicious, poisonous, and humanly destructive lie can be imagined. There must be an immediate return to sanity and the nuclear family headed by a married couple, husband and wife, as the basic building block of society. Point number 10. There must be a final solution to the Jewish question. Point number 11. The number of whites as a percentage of world population is now down into the single digits and falling fast. There can be no doubt that the white race is in danger of literal physical extinction. All of the white nations on earth are now accepting large numbers of non-white immigrants. The only one of the three major races of earth that is in real danger of extinction is the white race. It is absolutely essential that the white race acquire a homeland of its own, some place on earth where white children can be born and raised in physical and spiritual safety, and where our numbers may be restored and the threat of racial extinction overcome. Point number 12. History, economics, demographics, geography, and moral justice dictate that this worldwide homeland for all the Aryan peoples of the world be established in the Pacific Northwest, the land which is hallowed with the blood of martyrs, such as Sam and Vicky Weaver, Bob Matthews, Pastor Richard Butler, the Singer family, and now all of the comrades of the Northwest Volunteer Army who have perished during the past 5 years of armed struggle. While the Northwest Volunteer Army recognizes that we lack the power to overthrow that government completely and to take back our country in its entirety, for the sake not only of our own race but of all humanity, it is essential that the United States and the ruling elite which now controls the United States be clearly defeated in the eyes of the world, and that at least some portion of the North American continent be detached from federal control and returned to the original white people who created the world as we know it. The coming conference at Longview, Washington, will have one of two results: either the establishment of the Northwest Republic, or else a return to combat operations against the United States government on the part of the NVA. There is no third alternative. Well, our time is up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom.